Your gift to Kingston's longest-running broadcaster serving our community since 1922. Get a tax receipt via Queen's University or get sweet CFRC swag and enter to win our raffle draws featuring gifts from amazing local donors. For every $5 donated, you get one more chance to win. Thank you for your support.
I have something to tell you. Your fix of post-punk, new wave, garage rock, and proto-punk? Tuesdays at 11 a.m. Hey, but don't tell anyone. I'm Izzy, and this is Our Secret.
My name is Genevieve, and I'll be hosting Peace, Love, and Jenny on CFRC 101.9 FM on Saturday evenings at 8 p.m. We'll be exploring everything from pop and soul to funk, jazz, and even a touch of hip-hop. Music that spans decades but all connects through good vibes, peace and love, and of course, a little bit of me, Jenny. See you there!
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
Good evening. It is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Henry Walker, and Ellie MacArthur. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. University Hospitals Kingston Foundation, which supports both Kingston Health Sciences Center and Providence Care, is currently leading a landmark fundraising campaign, with anonymous local donors matching community donations by up to $100,000. The Double Your Donation Matching Gift Challenge runs until the end of the year, with matched gifts supporting the most pressing needs across both Kingston Health Sciences Center and Providence Care. Jeff Donner, Director of Marketing and Communications with UHKF, shared more about the Matching Gift Challenge with CFRC.
A matching gift challenge is powerful because it turns one person's generosity into something bigger. Every gift goes a little bit further instantly because of that matching element. And this time of year really highlights how deeply people in Kingston care about one another, especially when it comes to healthcare, especially knowing that we're entering into a very important era of healthcare in city and in the city of Kingston and beyond.
As Donner mentioned, local healthcare is at a pivotal moment, with local hospitals facing evolving demands and major projects on the horizon.
I think what's new this year is the intentionality behind the campaign. Mm-hmm. The news is definitely out there that land has been put aside for a new hospital and innovation complex. More news to come on that, obviously. But I think the most important takeaway from that is it reinforces how important investment in healthcare is for our region, particularly as we face a very large capital project that will take many, many years to complete. This is sort of our first foray into that type of landscape.
The funds raised through this challenge will also help hospitals respond to today's realities, including growing patient volumes, increasingly complex care needs, and the need for new technologies. From modern equipment and innovative treatments to staff support and system-wide improvements, the campaign helps turn community generosity into direct impact. Lori Fagiani, Director of Engagement and Sustainability with UHKF, emphasized that this is truly a community-driven effort, with donations staying local and directly supporting care close to home.
One of the nice things with working with the foundation is that the funds that we do raise through all of our campaigns and all of the different ways that we raise funds do stay local. So they are here and they are helping our friends, our families, our neighbors. The money that we raise is going to help, you know, you and your family. So that's a really important issue, that knowing that donor donations stay right here in Kingston to help our own community.
Donors can contribute through one-time or recurring gifts by visiting uhkf.ca/give. Once again, gifts made by December 31st, 2025 will be matched dollar for dollar by anonymous local donors, up to $100,000.
You know, as you know, hospitals don't slow down during the holiday. In many ways, needs increase. Community support during this season sends a powerful message to healthcare teams that they're not alone. And I think that's really the spirit of the campaign that we're trying to share with the public is we're here for you. And we invite your support to be here for one another as well through donation and through your participation in our holiday campaign. Every gift helps strengthen care across our hospitals.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it doesn't matter the size of the gift, it's the support. And this is the biggest, this is the season of giving. And so big, small, your donations are all greatly appreciated. Again, they will go to support local health care right here in Kingston, supporting our own family, our friends, our neighbors, the people that we know. And that makes a huge difference.
Kingston community organizations are working together to address intimate partner violence in KFLNA through a new awareness campaign. See It, Name It, Change It is an educational campaign encouraging community members to learn to identify harmful behaviors, call them out, and take safe, effective action. The working group behind the campaign came together in 2024, after City Council declared intimate partner violence an epidemic in the region in 2023. The group is comprised of Kingston Frontenac Anti-Violence Coordinating Committee, Kingston Interval House, Resolve Counseling Services, Kingston Anti-Violence Advisory Council, Southeast Public Health, the City of Kingston, and United Way, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington. The local campaign features photographs of Kingston community members holding signs with the campaign slogan. The photographs, taken by local photographer Will O'Hare, feature an Indigenous elder, a musician, a paramedic, the medical officer of health, a trades worker, the local Canadian Forces Base Commander, a Correctional Services Canada Commissioner, an artist, and a Queen student. See It, Name It, Change It launched in conjunction with the Global 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence, featuring the images and resources on social media and local digital displays. Ruth Nordegroff, Director of Community Development and Wellbeing and IIDEA at the City of Kingston, sat down with CFRC to share more about the campaign. For listeners who may not have heard of it yet, what is the See It, Name It, Change It campaign, and what is it aiming to do?
It's actually a campaign that was initially created in the Lanark County. So we are, you know, not that creative. We really build it off their initial campaign. And it's really focused on really education around intimate partner violence and really call people or support people to take action. Obviously, it kind of focuses on not only identifying, but also calling out, changing, and ultimately stopping intimate partner violence in our community.
Mm-hmm. And the campaign uses photographs of community members holding that message. I was wondering why this approach was chosen and what impact you guys are hoping it has.
Well, we want to make sure that it really feels as something that is, you know, touching everybody and everybody should be part of. So we choose, like, obviously some folks that people might recognize in our community. You know, we've chosen, you know, leaders of different institutions, musicians, artists, but also folks that work in, you know, certain professions like healthcare, trades, education. So we really wanted to make it like diverse and touch on everybody and hopefully also really create some, I would say, recognition in the community around this and starting a conversation.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned this has started in other cities. I was wondering if you could speak to why it was so important to bring this to Kingston now.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually something that we've been working on over the last few years. Obviously, I work for the City of Kingston and City Council back in 2023 actually declared intimate partner violence as an epidemic. There's about 100 municipalities that have done the same, and we're hopeful that at some point the province also will take that same approach. So we've, after that, really started to work on how do we bring all the partners together that work on preventing intimate partner violence and also supporting victims and members of the community. And we thought that this campaign would really be a good start to bring this message out in the community in an impactful way.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you've gotten any response, whether it's from folks who participated maybe in taking the pictures or folks who've seen the campaign.
Well, we launched it this week and we've definitely seen some responses on social media. People are really kind of picking this up in a positive way. What we really try to do as well is making sure that there's a link to resources. So if people see this campaign and they may want to learn more, that they actually go to the Kingston Frontenac Anti-Violence website, which has a survivor handbook and lots of other tools for people to educate themselves. So yeah, we've overall seen some positive reactions. We've received some questions around resources for all genders. So it's really good dialogue and conversation.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And where can folks find more about this campaign, view all these pictures, and find resources?
Well, hopefully on as many social media platforms as possible. We really hope it's kind of this opportunity for people to share and reshare these photos. But the different partners that have been working on this are the City of Kingston, the Kingston Frontenac Anti-Violence Coordinating Committee, Interval House, Resolve, the Southeast Health Units, and the United Way. So all those agencies will have these resources on their websites. But ultimately, we really hope that folks are going to the Kingston Frontenac Anti-Violence website, which has all the resources and tools.
Once again, that was Ruth Nordegroff with the City of Kingston on the See It, Name It, Change It campaign here in KFLNA. The working group hopes to expand the campaign to more locations in the coming months. For more information and resources, you can visit kfacc.org. Kingston Health Sciences Center has received $1.8 million in new funding from Ontario Health to expand services at its detoxification center. KHSC's Detox Center is the only publicly funded withdrawal management site between Ottawa and Oshawa, a crucial lifeline for people across eastern Ontario seeking recovery. Without it, many individuals would be left facing risky withdrawal at home, long wait times, or long-distance travel for support. The center currently operates as a Level 2 medically supported model. With this new investment, it will transition to a Level 3 detoxification site, offering 24-hour medical services. The funding will support several major enhancements, including 4 new medical support beds, 24/7 registered practical nurse coverage for continuous clinical oversight, a new nurse practitioner position for weekend coverage, and reclassification of all 22 existing beds as observation beds, allowing the center to fully operate them as intake-ready beds. KHSC's Executive Vice President of Patient Care and Chief Nursing Executive, Jason Hahn, spoke with CFRC about what this expansion means for addiction care across the region.
We now will have 24-hour medical management on site. So with this, we will be having registered practical nurses 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, as well as nurse practitioner support on the weekends, which is a great addition. So patients can present to the detoxification center, and it's voluntary presentation to the detoxification center for safely managed detoxification from alcohol or drugs. What this will provide is that we can medically monitor our patients. We can manage them through medications, through assessments. And when patients are detoxifying from alcohol or drugs, symptoms can be everything from, fever, chills, you can be quite anxious, restless, and agitated up to and including delirium. And in some cases, you can have increased heart rate and cardiac symptoms. And what we're seeing is there's a lot more toxic drugs out there. And as a result, the withdrawal symptoms are much, much more severe. So this will really help us manage them medically. And what it really will help is, you know, when they enter our detoxification center, they can stay with us. Prior to that, they would have to, if we were not able to manage them there, their medically manage them at the detoxification center, they would either have to go to our emergency department at the KGH site to be managed, up to including an inpatient mission to one of our inpatient beds, say a medicine bed at KGH site, or to our mental health and addictions inpatient units. So really providing safe, you know, trauma-informed addiction care and management at the detox center. And as a result of the funding, our goal is to increase the number of patients that we're going to care for in a year by 20%. And we care for about 760 patients now on an annual basis.
This upgrade comes at a critical time. The local drug supply is becoming increasingly toxic, and more clients are arriving at the hospital sicker and with more medical complications than ever before. Overall, KHSC says the enhanced services will help more people withdraw safely, reduce pressure on hospitals, and strengthen the region's addiction care system.
You know, as a result of going from a level 2 to a level 3 now with medical management 24/7. So we built capacity. We have regulated healthcare professionals that'll be on site 24/7. So we're able to provide the care for the patients that present there. So if, for example, in our current model, you know, we could have a patient that's detoxifying and you know, we're caring for them, but we're not able to medically manage them. So, for example, you know, they develop increased heart rate, they become quite agitated or delirious. We would have to transfer them to the emergency department at a KGH. That would include plus or minus an admission to an inpatient unit. So, you know, if you think about that, you know, you provide the care and we're able to improve access. So if you think about it being a voluntary detoxification center, so, you know, patients walk up to the door. I mean, you know, we always request if they call ahead just to make sure, but, you know, you could walk up and knock on the door and we're able to accept them. And at times now we're saying we don't have capacity and we're not able to manage you, but, you know, please go to the emergency department for care. So if you think about just, you know, providing care and compassionate care for the patients that are struggling with addiction, and addiction is a health issue. So, you know, patients and individuals with addictions to whether alcohol or drugs deserve compassionate, quality medical care.
KHSC hopes these changes will make it easier and safer for people to take that first, often hardest step toward recovery. To learn more about Kingston's Detoxification Center, located at 240 Brock Street, visit the KHSC website. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the week. We begin with Monday, December 22nd, daytime high of -2, going to feel closer to -6, a 41% chance of snow throughout the day, but just a small total, a centimeter, maybe 2. Tuesday, December 23rd, slightly warmer, daytime high of 3 degrees, but with the wind chill, it'll feel closer to -3, and a 61% chance of light snow in the forecast. Wednesday, December 24th, Christmas Eve, daytime high of -2, but with the partly sunny conditions, it'll feel closer to 0. Thursday, December 25th, Christmas Day. Here in the city of Kingston, we have got a daytime high of 4 degrees with a 62% chance of precipitation, only dropping down to 2 degrees overnight. Friday, December 26th, Boxing Day. Colder here in the city of Kingston, daytime high of 3, feeling closer to -3 with the wind chill, dropping down to -6 overnight, and with a 67% chance of precipitation, that means we could see some icy conditions early Saturday morning. Saturday, December 27th, daytime high of minus 2 with sleet and freezing rain in the forecast for the afternoon. So be careful if you've got some post-Christmas travel planned. And that extends to Sunday, December 28th as well. Still going to have that mix of sleet and freezing rain throughout the day with a high of minus 2. And then moving into the start of next week, we have got Monday, December 29th, a daytime high of minus 4, feeling closer to minus 9 with an overnight low of minus 7, a chilly start to the final week of 2025. This is the City of Kingston Traffic Report for the week. As a reminder, winter traffic parking restrictions are in effect as of December 1st. This means that during December and March, overnight on-street parking will be banned only if the weather and conditions require it, so if it's particularly snowy or icy. But during January and February, all overnight on-street parking is banned, no matter the weather conditions. It is a short list of road closures this week. Aberdeen William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street Princess 2 Mac is also closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Berry Street Queen to Colborne is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. And then in terms of other delays, Bay Ridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure. Catarocway Woods Drive, Centennial to Gardeners, expect delays for the construction of a multi-use pathway. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect those same delays for flood proofing, traffic reduced to one lane in each direction. And Victoria Street and Earl Street, expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
This is Christina coming back at you with your concerts and events calendars for this week. Starting off with concerts, if live music is how you're spending the week, Kingston's got you covered. Tonight kicks off smoothly with Jazz Monday at the RCHA featuring Mike Myers and Rick Flanagan, starting at 4:30. Over at the Cove Inn, Kentucky takes the stage at 5, and if you're heading out later, Musiki has live jazz starting at 8. On Tuesday, the RCHA hosts Tom's Tuesday Happy Hour Jam through the afternoon, while Paula Wood and Friends brings things to Time Out Bar at 6. You can also catch Eric and Megan at the Cove Inn if you're looking for something laid back. Christmas Eve offers a quieter musical moment with carols and candlelight at the Spire at 7 p.m. Looking ahead to the weekend, Lucas Oak hits Spearhead Brewery Friday night, and Saturday is packed, including the Cabin Fever Holiday Hoedown with the Adam Knapp Band at the Cove Inn, Django's Kitchen at Musiki, and Dr. Bombay at Tiernanog. Those are just a few concerts coming up this week. You can check out CFRC.ca for our full concerts listings. Now for your CFRC community events calendar. Tonight you can warm up with karaoke at Time Out Bar starting at 6. Or put your knowledge to the test at Trivia Night at Brass Pub or Something in the Water Brewing. Tuesday features the Kingston Public Market at Springer Market Square, along with a community song circle at Kingston Community House in the evening. There's also Christmas trivia at the Mansion if you're feeling festive. On Christmas Eve, trivia and karaoke pop up around town, including at Wild Wing, Jersey's, and Time Out Bar. Later on in the week, Saturday brings another day at the Public Market, plus Vibrant Voices, a song circle for 2S LGBTQIA+ community and allies at the Kingston Frontenac Public Library. You can also roll into board game night at Studio 330. Closing out the weekend, Sunday features a blues social and dance at Daft Brewing, followed by karaoke at The Merchant and The Toucan. Once again, those are just a few events and concerts coming up this week. You can check out CFRC's full events and concerts calendars at CFRC.ca. Have an event or concert you'd like to add to our online or on-air calendar? You can visit CFRC.ca or check out the link in our bio on Instagram at CFRC Music. Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
Hello, this is Christina Lori, CFRC's local journalism initiative news reporter. Does local news matter to you? CFRC's annual funding drive campaign is now underway through December 31st, and you can help CFRC keep our listeners informed on issues that matter with modernized broadcasting equipment and trained team members. Help CFRC raise $25,000 this year and make your gift today via CFRC.ca. Don't forget to tune in for daily news programming and subscribe to our news podcast to keep up with the latest in your community.
Revelation Radio. Explore the sound shaping subculture. Tune in to 101.9 CFRC Wednesdays from 11 to noon to uncover revelations mixed into music from across the alternative scene, underground, and across the globe.
Brothers, the revolution will be live.
Revelation Radio, Wednesdays at 11.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office and supported by your friends at Modern City Taxi, we're pleased to present 47 Teeth's new track, Portland Flower. The song and music video are about struggling with the unknown, like wanting to take a leap of faith but not knowing if you're making the right decision, or hoping that you're letting go of the right things and won't get burned in the process. Ultimately, the song is an emotional call for guidance from the universe. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Portland Flower by 47 Teeth on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
This is my new music, feelings. CFRC from Kingston, Ontario. Your volunteer program, Campus and Community Radio at 101.9 FM and on the web at cfrc.ca.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoff, and this is edition 296. On the broadcast this week, I'm going to be sharing a conversation with a member of the Tasmanian Palestine Advocacy Network. You can find them online at tpan.info. The last 2 years has seen unprecedented mobilizations around the world in solidarity with the Palestinian people. These street-level and community-level mobilizations for justice have really been at odds with the political and economic interests of Western power structures. In the context of Australia, a territory that is Indigenous territory, I thought it would be important to hear from a local organization that is building support for Palestinian human rights in Australia, but also visiting and addressing the dynamics around Indigenous solidarity work locally. It was really a pleasure to hear about the Tasmanian Palestine Advocacy Network for this edition of Free City Radio. Here's my conversation.
The last 2 years has seen massive solidarity actions with the Palestinian people taking place all across the globe. That, of course, includes Australia, where in recent weeks, and we're speaking in August 2025, there's been a very significant protest that took place in Sydney, Australia. I'm sure some people hearing this will have seen images of many, many thousands of people walking across a major bridge in Sydney. Of course, that's one moment, but there's ongoing organizing in different parts of Australia, and that includes Tasmania. So I think that it would be really interesting for people to hear a bit about the group in Tasmania, and then just sort of getting a sense of the multitude of organizing in Australia. Of course, there's a connection to Australia's own colonial history vis-a-vis Indigenous people. Maybe that's a good place to start, but first, just please fully introduce yourself, how you'd like to, how you'd like people to hear from you and the organization that you're part of.
Absolutely. My name's Caitlin Shaheen. I am a white settler that lives in Lutruwita, Tasmania. Lutruwita is the Indigenous Palawa name for Tasmania. Specifically, I live in a city of Nipaluna, or Hobart in English. I've been living here for 3 years with my husband, who is a Palestinian man. His parents are from Gaza and Al-Lid, which is currently part of occupied Palestine. We, in among other activists, in late or early November 2023, like many people around the world, were at a loss. We were forced into deep, spontaneous grief, watching it on our screens, with, you know, holding our breath, knowing that this was not going to be a great time for Palestinians. Not that the last 77 years has been a great time for Palestinians, but knowing specifically what this type of blueprint that the Israeli occupation would walk down. And I think, sadly, we're sitting here, you know, 18, 19 months later with that exact reality. And the group that I'm a part of is called the Tasmanian Palestine Advocacy Network, so TPAN for short. It's probably a lot easier to refer to us as TPAN. And we're made up of a group of grassroots activists who all live predominantly in Nipaluna, but we do have activists from across the state. Lutruwita, Tasmania, is a very, very interesting place. For those who don't know Australia very well, we are an island off the mainland island of Australia, so quite geographically isolated. And that definitely has an impact on the type of grassroots work that we do. There's sort of a mentality here of regional, rural mentality of that isolationist perspective in the community. But conversely, and also more importantly, that has manifested itself in other types of activism to be sort of quite strong and quite powerful because of that sort of need of advocacy in general. So we felt very supported in November of 2023 to embark on this grassroots activism for Palestine. We were preceded, and they still exist, by a smaller group called Friends of Palestine Tasmania, which was mainly run by retirees who, for whatever reason, over the course of their life had become involved with the issue of Palestine. And they just didn't have the capacity at the time to sort of start doing mass protests. They had previously done a lot more educational resourcing, small Nakba Remembrance Day marches and fundraising activities, you know, quite sporadically. So obviously we had a lot of momentum. We were trying to channel this grief somewhere. We were trying to experience that grief in community and with people. And that really just manifested itself very first and foremost with just meeting once a week at the steps of our town hall, which, you know, is a colonial marker. So obviously there's that deep, deep mirrored history of occupation and genocide, massacres, colonial violence and other human rights abuses. And we started off as 30 people, you know, in a place as regional, as small as Nipaluna. You know, we weren't really sure of the reception that we were going to get. We weren't sure if people even knew really where Palestine was. They didn't really know much about Middle Eastern politics. And I'm now talking predominantly about the white dominant culture that we have in Australia. So obviously discluding Aboriginal folks, Indigenous people of this land, Arabs in diaspora, Muslims, you know, all of these groups of people already knew about the topic of Palestine. But potentially the dynamic is that they didn't have a space to talk about Palestine. So when October 2023 hit, there's a void. There's a void in the space. And we started organically. We formed in a car park. You know, we made a sort of quasi committee so we could get some decisions made. We could get a logo. We could start an Instagram page. We could, you know, and organize ourselves very organically. And since we've just been organizing ever since, every single day, I've become lifelong friends with some of my fellow organizers. And, you know, if there was a positive side to all of this, it would be that ability for grassroots organizations like TPAN to instill a sense of belonging for pro-Palestinian people. And like I said, that's always included Indigenous folk, Arabs, Palestinians, Muslims. It's been sort of like the honor of, at least for me, is to even be a part of creating that space for people who need to grieve and people who need to feel connected to each other through this time.
For people who are hearing this, Nipaluna is there's a larger area of Nipaluna, and there's a colonial name for the city, which I believe is Hobart. Yeah, just for people to sort of have a sense of where you're talking about. Thank you for that. The dynamics that you're describing about holding space, I think, are really important. And a number of people in different cities around the world have named that and talked about the power of demonstrations in relation to holding that space in a public setting, but also the learning that happens in social movements. The late scholar Aziz Chaudhry, who had quite a few connections to Australia and New Zealand, he always wrote and talked about the learning within social movements and the sort of cross-pollination that takes place. I would imagine in your particular context, that means also some people coming to terms with and learning about Indigenous struggles and history in the context of Australia. So It'd be great to, of course, hear about your ongoing work to lift up and speak to the genocide that is taking place in Gaza right now at the hands of the Israeli state, but how acting against that also creates space to talk about other critical issues like contemporary indigenous struggles today in Australia, which are obviously ongoing.
Absolutely. Yeah, we've been very fortunate to be welcomed so warmly by the Aboriginal community here in Nipaluna specifically, but also across Lutruwita. So just to give a brief rundown for people who might not be aware about sort of the mechanism of British colonization that happened on this land. Tasmania, unfortunately, was quite affected by the British colonization, I would say probably more widespread than mainland Australia. And potentially that has a lot to do with the smaller geography of the place, but also just with sort of settlers landing in specific times and in specific places with specific ideas in mind. So unfortunately, the traditional owners of this land, the Muwinina people, did not survive colonization. We actually experienced a total genocide of these people on this land. And a lot of people don't know that. So at the moment, the Aboriginal people of Lutruwita are actually a combination of many indigenous groups that have had to piece together their indigeneity through experiencing extremely widespread genocide. So they now band together under the term Palawa, which basically means Tasmanian Aboriginal. And they are kind of one cohesive group now. They are trying to reactivate many languages through the creation of Palawakani, so the speak of Tasmanian Aboriginals, which collects whatever remnants of all of these diverse languages that used to exist to come and bring them together. So the story of genocide on this land is deeply traumatic. It's omnipresent, as in you can still feel it today, again, because we have an indigenous population attempting their revival actively. And that was something that a few of the organizers of TPAN really wanted to bring with us on whatever educational journey we were going to offer the general population about Palestine. We can't, speak about a settler colonial project unless we're willing to interrogate the one that we are a part of. And that was very important to us and still is very important to us. So I'm not sure if you have it in Canada, but in Australia, we have this idea or concept of welcome to country and acknowledgement of country. So welcome to country is only able to be given by an Indigenous person and only able to be given by an Indigenous person of their traditional lands. An acknowledgement of country can be given by anyone, but that's basically like if you're not a part of that group, you're acknowledging the traditional lands and the people who have sovereignty over them. And that, in a Western colonial mindset, you know, people see that as a tick box. So they say a little script and they make it very impersonal and they just sort of do it because they have to. And that's the way that, you know, the society has told them to behave. But when we speak with Palawa mob here, they have requested of us to make it more personal. So when we're acknowledging that lands, we talk about deep friendship and deep shared histories between the Palestinians and Indigenous Tasmanians, because they are the first people who can recognize what a genocide looks like, having gone through such an extensive genocide themselves. So at the forefront of our mind in TPAN is to always learn from that, and to learn not only the deep trauma, but also the sense of resistance, right? And we are always grateful for whatever advice, whatever space that they can give us. So every time we're at our rallies, we always do an acknowledgement to country and we always share resources or events or initiatives that our local Aboriginal community would be requesting. We lend our support for their protests, their, their climate actions, whatever we can. You know, it's never too much to ask, because for us, we see the dismantling of the settler colonial project here as important as the one in Palestine. They cannot be divorced from each other. We cannot be seen to be advocating for an indigenous sovereignty halfway across the world if we're not willing to challenge that in our home. So we've managed to do quite a bit of work with the local Palawa community. We were fortunate enough to get a bit of money from a federal body, some grant money, and we decided to put on a program that we titled Sharing Histories. And this was a set of, I think every month we did an event where we basically looked at the parallels of the history of Palestinians and the history of local Tasmanian Aboriginals. And these centered around themes. So the first one was actually a closed community event, so only Tasmanian Aboriginals, Palestinians or Arabs could attend. So no white settlers. It was just a space for them to share that deep connection to country, that deep connection to culture. You know, maybe even actively mourn that if it's missing from them, or reinforce the relationship they have to that. And then sort of all the events after that were publicly open. So we did one centering around food, which we hosted during Ramadan this year. Yeah. So we invited people from the Aboriginal community to partake in iftar, and we did a bit of a cultural sharing, and they shared a bit about food sovereignty and natural native products and how to eat them, how to cook them, what season to harvest them in or forage. We did one about music, where Tasmanian Aboriginal woman could speak her spoken poetry, her spoken word poetry, and sing morning songs for us. We had an oud player play who's from Gaza. We did a dubka workshop together. So, you know, it was just trying to sort of understand in a cultural way that these two issues are intertwined, that although they look very different, they are very different cultures, that overall, like, our goal is to maintain indigenous sovereignty in these places and maintain and fight against erasure of indigenous cultures. We had a really good public reception to these events, very well attended. And I think a lot of people, like we were sort of saying before, almost need events like this to hold a mirror against how they see the settler colonial project in Australia. You know, it might, in some ways, it's sometimes easier to look at something over there in the Middle East or away from you and sort of say, yeah, of course that's wrong. But to have that mirror to show them up close that it's actually always been wrong was very important to us. And in turn, you know, some of our most staunch supporters are from the Tasmanian Aboriginal community. And again, no ask is too much for them. They will show up at every single event. They will, they freely speak about their connection to Palestine, the topic that a lot of them have had a connection to since the moment they were born. They've seen this struggle for indigenous self-determination a world away, and they understand it implicitly. So yeah, we've been very grateful for that meaningful friendship and meaningful connection with them, and we hope that, you know, long after Palestine is free, that we would continue to maintain that connection until there's treaty on this land at a bare minimum, which I don't know, for people who aren't familiar with the history of colonialism here, that Australia doesn't have treaty with its indigenous populations, which many other countries do, and it's a deep shame of our country that we do not have this. So yeah, it's a poignant reminder that there's still a lot to do here, as well as a lot to do with Palestine.
The term here in Canada is unceded territory, and that is the majority of territory of what is called Canada. Thanks for sharing that context. Maybe you could just talk a bit about important ways that you feel grassroots activism can change the conversation. I noticed that the actions in Australia have clearly had an impact on the government. The actions on the streets have impacted government policy in many places. And I feel like there's often this sort of tension around the acknowledgement that popular protests do shape major international policy decisions, whether it's in Australia or France or South Africa, and the role of social movements. And I would be interested in hearing your perspective on that from an Australian context.
Yeah, absolutely. Australia's a big place, so sometimes it's hard. There's not sort of one blueprint that works, but I can definitely speak to sort of how TPAN has found that connection as a grassroots movement to the sort of systems that we can interact with. Because Tasmania is such a small place with a smallish population, we've actually found it to be quite easy to access our political system, much more so than a major city where there might be lots of layers and barriers to jump through. I mean, I can walk where we walk for our protests on a fortnightly basis. One of the federal senators' offices is nearby our route. So, you know, it's that proximity to the political system that we have. And thankfully, we have a lot of in-person access to these change makers from the whole spectrum of politics. Obviously, we are, you know, more welcome on the left side of the spectrum. And we've thankfully got a really great party here called the Greens Party, who has from the beginning been supportive of grassroots activism groups. Specifically, one senator we have here, Nick McKim, has done some marvelous work with us and often, you know, is not asking us to change or mitigate our stance to suit his agenda. He, you know, sort of verbatim will pass on our requirements or our demands. So one distinct example was my husband basically wrote a speech, a 2-minute speech, because that's how much this senator had in parliament. And he simply got up and said, "These are the words of Faraz Shaheen," and he said the whole speech, and that was it. And, you know, that was shared across Australia, and people were really responsive to that type of engagement from our political candidates and representatives, who I would argue that's the actual reason that they're elected, is to do that sort of work, is to put the voice of the community on a larger scale. So we've had great, relationships with him, and his entire office has been amazing. They gave us free office space. They print off all our flyers. They, you know, help us fundraise by doing specific events and things like that. So we've been quite fortunate with them. And thankfully, the Greens Party in Australia was actually founded in Tasmania. So there's a deep sort of respect and love of that political party in this place. And it's got a long history with climate activism and other activist initiatives that all started grassroots. So that's sort of like in the minds of a lot of people here, I would say, is that history and that connection to grassroots activism. Other things that we're able to do is, again, you know, purely just a response to the small population and maybe the lack of bureaucracy that exists. But we've been able to do a lot more spontaneous actions with sort of little repercussions. For a while there, at the start of the latest iteration of genocide, we were doing what we called die-ins, where we would just spontaneously go to very popular places. Everyone would lay down on the ground, draped in their kafirs, and one of our spokespeople would read off the names of the people who'd been killed that day. And we were able to do that with no issue. No one tried to stop us. No police were called. Some heckling from general population, but by and large, you know, not a huge sort of response or overwhelming anti-Palestinian sentiment. And we've, you know, we've had some, because of that and because of the general sort of, acceptance that, if not on the issue of Palestine, but on the acceptance alone that grassroots activism is fundamentally a right and fundamentally a value to the society. We've just been able to sort of open a lot of doors really fast, I think. People obviously have a sense that this issue is very urgent. I mean, people are losing their lives every single hour of every single day and have done for, you know, far too long. But I think that paired with the sort of the fabric of Tasmanian society by and large, of this sort of acceptance of activism, I think has really helped us, that I know that some of the major cities on the mainland of Australia have not experienced. I mean, you commented earlier about the Sydney march, and there was a huge, you know, they had to go to the Supreme Court to basically be able to do that march. And thankfully the court found in their favor. But yeah, we've not had that kind of, I guess, hurdles here, which has sort of meant that we've been able to keep momentum. We've been able to diversify our activism through many streams.
That gives us a picture and some context. So thank you so much for taking the time to outline that. And so just also before we go, if you could just share the name of your website for the group, the Solidarity Initiative in Tasmania. And also we'll include that in the notes on this program. So for anybody hearing on an AM or FM station in Canada, this is Free City Radio, and you can find our archives at soundcloud.com/Free City Radio. So please share the website of your organization. And thanks again for being with us.
Thank you. Yeah, so you can find all more about Tasmanian Palestine Advocacy Network at our website, which is tpan.info. Or more prominently, we do a lot of our activism online and social media, like many groups. And our handle is tpanlutruwita. Lutruwita spelled Lutruwita.
That was a member of the Tasmania Palestine Advocacy Network. You can learn more about this group in Australia at tpan.info. I'm Stefan Christoph. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. Thank you to the Social Justice Center at Concordia University for supporting this radio project. We broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CJLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m., and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Stefan Christoph, and I'll speak to you next week.